Some of the earliest albums recorded for popular commercial distribution were comedy albums. For example, various collections of humorous short stories recited by vaudeville comedians were very popular. The OK label pioneered the practice of on-location recordings, and in 1920s, OK printed thousands of records. But the record most commonly associated with the label might be the OK Laughing Record. Welcome to Dead Wax 78. I'm your host, Sean, and yep, this is the podcast where we're going to talk about all that crazy old-time music and today about comedy. Today's show is called Shellac Shenanigans. Described by the Library of Congress as one of the most unusual, influential, and surprisingly enduring novelty records ever recorded, the OK Laughing Record is exactly what its name implies. It begins with a cornetist playing a sad, mournful tune. Suddenly a woman laughs and interrupts the performance, temporarily stalling the solo. As the cornet continues to play, the woman keeps laughing, and soon a male laughing voice joins her. That's really all there is to it. The OK Laughing Record is fundamentally simple, but also strange, and its unusual nature quickly made it into an international sensation. One of the best-known comedians was Cal Stewart. He recorded monologues of jokes as the rustic Uncle Josh in the late 1890s. Stewart included some of the earliest recorded banana peel jokes in his album, Uncle Josh in the Department Store, in 1903. Now, Cal, born in 1856 in Charlotte County, Virginia, was an American comedian and humorist who pioneered in vaudeville and early sound recordings. He's best remembered for his comic monologues in which he played Uncle Josh Weathersby, a resident of a mythical New England farming town called Pumpkin Center, or as they would say it, Punkin Center. Stewart spent his early life working in circuses, medicine shows, and vaudeville to great acclaim as Uncle Josh Weathersby from way down east. It was on the road that he befriended Mark Twain and later Will Rogers, two men who shared that similar crazy wit and comedy. Around 1897, Thomas Edison Studios hired him to cut several cylinders recordings of his famous speeches and songs. They were well received by the public and launched an entire series of recordings based on the Uncle Josh character. Stewart's trademark on these recordings is his easily recognizable laugh that precedes his speeches. Best-selling recordings included Uncle Josh's Arrival in New York, I'm Old But I'm Awfully Tough, Jim Lawson's Horse Trade with the Deacon Witherspoon, Uncle Josh's Huskin' Bee Dance, and Uncle Josh Buys an Automobile. He also wrote some songs including Ticklish Reuben. I've never heard it, but it sounds interesting. Stewart continued recording on Edison, Columbia, Victor, and other independent labels up until his death on December 7, 1919. He also wrote two books based on his monologues and performed in theaters across America with his wife. Here's part one, Uncle Josh Buys an Automobile, Cal Stewart on Edison Diamond Disc, 1915.
Well, I've gone and done it. Yes, Nancy nagged at me until I bought an automobile. Nancy said the Willets had one, the Weavers had one, and here we was riding around in a buckboard wagon with a bone-spavin horse that had spring halt and was blind on the off side. Well, I didn't hanker for that gasoline wagon, but in order to keep peace in the family, I sold 4 head of cattle, my oats and corn, 20 hogs, 10 ton of hay, and put a mortgage on the farm and bought an automobile. I picked it out of a mail order catalog and had the National Bank of Pumpkin Center send them the money. Well, in about a week it come for freight and we got it unloaded and Tim Lawson hauled it up to our front yard and I think all Pumpkin Center turned out to see it. And Nancy hasn't been as tickled over anything since her crazy quilt took a prize at the county fair as she was over that joy wagon. Well, I felt it in my bones I'd made a fool of myself or soon would, so next day I filled it full of gasoline and got all ready to take Nancy, Jim Lawson, and Ezra Hoskins out for a ride. I got out the book of rules, and the more I read it, the less I knew about the innards of that machine. Jim said I had to turn the crank to shoot it off. I turned that crank until my eyes stuck out, but it wouldn't budge. Nancy said the bobbin was wound too tight, or else the shuttle was threaded wrong. Ezra Hoskins said he thought maybe I didn't have the right kind of gasoline and wanted to sell me a barrel he had at the store. By that time, all Pumpkin Center was there and giving advice. Lige Willard said I ought to talk kindly to it and offer it some oats. Hank Weaver said I ought to lead it around for a spell until it got to know me. And Cy Pettingill said maybe I hadn't watered it yet. And Deacon Witherspoon wanted to offer prayer. Well, I grabbed hold of that crank again, and it flew back and hit me on the shins, and I sat down in the yard to think it over, and Nancy said the language I used was just shameful. Just then, Jim Lawson said, "Don't this plug go in somewhere?" We found where it went, and I turned the crank again, and that machine began to rear and snort and started off like a skyrocket. And there was a lot of things happened in less time than it takes to tell it. That machine started off across lots and everything with it. Ran over Hank Weaver's dog, tore a hole through Willett's picket fence, knocked over Cy Pettingill's beehives, and kept right on a-going. Well, I worked every lever that machine had, and every one made it go faster. Nancy was screaming, Ezra Hoskins was praying, and it wouldn't be right to tell what Jim Lawson was doing, but Nancy said it sounded like he was talking to the Lord. Just then we went through Ab Whitaker's wheat field and set it on fire, and I managed to steer it onto the turnpike road, but that didn't help matters any, cause it only hit the road once in a while. It tore down the toll gate, ripped down one side of the covered bridge, then started off through Dave Fisher's pasture and killed 4 sheep and a cow a haystack. That's all I remember now. All I've got to show for that joyride is a broken leg, some rubber tires, 6 lawsuits, and a mortgage on the farm. Nancy says if we ever own another one, we will have a regular chiffonier to run it. I ain't saying much, but I've got a lingering suspicion that all my joyriding will be done in the old buckboard wagon.
Joe Heyman's 1913, Cohen on the Telephone, part of a series of routines about a Jewish immigrant besieged by technology, Joe first recorded the monologue in London in July 1913 for Regal Records. and was issued in the U.S. by Columbia Records. Heyman's version of the song reached over 2 million sales in the United States. The success of the record led to cover versions recorded by performers such as Monroe Silver in 1914 and Barney Barnard, whose version was recorded in March 1916 for Victor Records. In 1927, Victor issued an electric recording of monologues by Julius Tannen and George Thompson. Now, Heyman recorded a similar routine entitled Cohen Buys a Wireless Set in 1923 for Columbia. Joe, originally from Philadelphia, his real name being Hyman rather than Heyman, and his older brother Jacob Hyman, was one of Harry Houdini's first partners in his magic act. Hyman and Houdini had met while working at a necktie factory. They performed as the Brothers Houdini. Cohen on the Telephone is one of those classic vaudeville routines performed by so many, it can seem almost like a work of folk art. It was the first comedy record to sell over a million copies and may be the most famous piece of Hebrew dialect humor. Here's part two, Cohen on the Telephone, Joe Heyman, Columbia, 1913.
Description of the efforts of Mr. Cohen to use the telephone for the first time. Mr. Cohen is trying to call up the manager of a certain bank who happens to be his landlord. The conversation is as follows. Hello, are you there? Hello. Hello, what? What number do I want? Well, what numbers have you got? Excuse me, my fault. I want Central 248, please. Yes, that's right. 248. I say, miss. Am I supposed to keep on saying, are you there, and hello, until you come back again? Well, don't be long. Hello, are you there? Oh, yes. Are you the bank? Yes. I want to see the manager, please. I say, I want to see... What do you say? This is not a telescope, it's a telephone? You're very clever this morning, ain't it? Well, do me a favor. Hang a small piece of crepe on your nose. Your brains are dead. And if I have any more of your impertinence, I'll speak to the manager about you. I say, oh, I'm speaking to them. Oh, you're the manager. I beg your pardon. I'm much obliged. Say, Mr. Manager, I rang up to tell you that I'm your tenant, Cohen. I say, I'm your tenant, Cohen. I ain't going. I'm stopping here. I'm your tenant, not Lieutenant Cohen. I want to tell you that last night the wind came and blow down the shutter outside my house. And I want you to send... I say last night the wind came and... The wind. Not the devil, the wind. The wind. But you know what... Like that. Well, that blew my shutter down outside my house. And I want you... I say it blew the shutter out. The shutter. No, I didn't say shut up. No, the shutter. The thing that goes down the front of the shop. I want you to send the carpenter to mend the shutter. I say, I want you to send the carpenter to mend the shutter. To mend the... Not a tremendous shutter, no. Hello, are you there? Yeah, last night the wind came and blew down the shutter outside my house. And I want you to send the carpenter. A carpenter, a workman, yes. You know, one of those fellas that hits the hammer with the nails, that's it. A workman. I want you to send a workman to mend the damaged shutter. I say I want you to send a workman to mend. To mend. Not two men, no, one man, two men. One man to mend the damaged shutter. To mend the damage. I ain't swearing at you, I'm only telling you. Are you there? Last night the wind came and blew down the shutter outside my house. And I want you to send a carpenter. A carpenter? Oh, never mind, I'll have it fixed myself.
Immigrants and African Americans decisively shaped the multi-ethnic urban popular culture in the late 19th century. built in large measure of the emergence of vaudeville. Vaudeville blended slapstick comedy, minstrel shows, sentimental songs into a rich and highly popular cultural stew. Among the most successful vaudeville practitioners were two Jewish singers and comics from the mean streets of Manhattan's Lower East Side, Joe Weber and Lou Fields. Weber and Fields' routine usually featured broad stereotypes of immigrants. Fields played Meyer, the shrewd city slicker who wanted to put one over on Weber's Mike, the dumb newcomer. At the peak of their popularity in 1904, Weber and Fields recorded a popular routine, The Hypnotist, for their first commercial sales. Ironically, just a few months after recording that routine, the Weber and Fields team broke up, ending nearly three decades of public performances, the longest of any team in American popular theater. In the case of Weber and Fields, or Mike and Meyer as the characters were known, as well as many of the other acts of this genre, often involve stereotyping by dress and behavior, as well as comedic and often sympathetic portrayals of characters' attempts to fit into American society. Always the crafty scheme or the make it big scheme in America. A typical Mike and Meyer routine involved Mike, the short, clever one, unsuccessfully trying to coach Meyer, the tall, simple one, in a scheme to get them a free lunch at the working class saloon. Here's part three, Weber and Fields, baseball game on Columbia.
By golly, Mike, every time I see you, you're getting fatter and fatter. Why don't you take exercises?
What do you mean, exercise?
Did you ever play baseball?
Sure, that's the same as you play chicken cricket.
The same thing, only different. In baseball, there are nine men on a side and an umpire.
What side is the umpire on?
He's always on the wrong side. When the players can't decide who is right, then they call the umpire.
What did they call him?
I'm ashamed to tell you. You see, after the players hit the ball, he runs for first base.
Does the umpire have to run for a base?
No, but sometimes he's got to run for his life. The most important thing in the baseball is the pitcher.
Oh, that's in case the players get thirsty.
No.
Well, ain't the pitcher filled with water?
No, but sometimes it's filled with beer. Don't you understand? The pitcher throws the ball to the catcher past the batter.
The water?
The batter, the fellow who tries to hit the ball.
But suppose he don't hit it?
Then the umpire calls a strike.
Oh, then every union man must quit his job.
There ain't no union in this.
Well, what does the umpire call a strike for?
Just because the batter let the ball go by him.
Would he let a high ball go by him?
That wouldn't be a strike. That would be an impossibility. After the batter hits the ball, everybody looks up in the air.
What do they look up in the air for?
They are watching the pitcher trying to catch the fly.
Why don't they use fly paper?
It ain't that kind of a fly.
I don't know one kind of a fly from another.
When the ball goes up in the air straight, it's called a fly. Unless it goes behind the batter, then it's a foul.
Or if it's a fly, then it's a foul. I suppose after a while it's a passage.
Sometimes it happens that one of the batters make a home run.
What does he run home for?
He don't run home. He runs around the bases and puts his foot on the plate.
Now, I wouldn't eat out of such a plate after he puts his foot in it.
There ain't any eating in this game.
Then I don't want to play. All right, I play if you let me be the pitcher.
I'll even do better. I let you be the umpire. Because when 30,000 people yell, kill the umpire, I laugh myself to death.
Hey, what do they call a home team?
Every big city like New York, Philadelphia, Boston, Chicago boasts of a baseball team that's named after it.
Does St. Louis boast of such a team?
It's got one, but it don't boast of it.
Russell Hunting was an American comic, entertainer, and pioneer of sound recordists, and an influential figure in the early years of the recorded music industry. He was described as the most popular pre-1900 recording artist. Born in West Roxbury, Massachusetts, and he began his career as a dramatic actor in the Boston Theatre Company. He also began his recording career around 1891, recording for the New England Phonograph Company. Russell became famous for his series of comedy sketches about an Irish character named Michael Casey. The recordings consisted of rapid-fire crosstalk between two characters, in which Hunting, taking all the parts and playing all of them himself. From 1892, he recorded the Michael Casey skits for Columbia, as well as for other companies as well. From 1892, he recorded the Michael Casey skits for Columbia and other record companies, but several of these recordings, such as Michael Casey at the Telephone and Michael Casey Taking the Census, became famous. But in 1893, Hunting recorded the earliest version of the baseball poem Casey at the Bat on a Columbia graphophone. After that, his popular Casey format was often imitated. He also, about this time, recorded a series of indecent recordings for saloons and amusement arcades on Coney Island, using pseudonyms such as Manly Tempest and Willie Fathand. Hunting was identified by his distinctive voice and was arrested for violating obscenity laws. Hunting was found guilty and spent 3 months in prison. Here's part four, Casey at the Bat, Russell Hunting on Columbia.
Recitation entitled Casey's at the Bat for Columbia Phonograph Company of New York and London. There was ease in Casey's manner as he stepped into his place. Pride in Casey's cunning and a smile on Casey's face. And when responding to the cheers he lightly doffed his hat, no stranger in the crowd could doubt was Casey at the Bat. 10,000 eyes were on him as he rubbed his hands with dirt. 5,000 tones applauded when he wiped them on his throat. When the pitcher ground the ball into his hip, defiance gleamed in Casey's eyes, a sneer curled Casey's lip. And now the little covered spear come hustling through the air, and Casey stood a-watching it in haughty grandeur there. Brought by the sturdy batsman, the ball unheeded fit. That is my style, said Casey. Strike one, the umpire said. From the bench's black foot table, there went up a muffled roar, like the beating of storm waves on a stern and distant shore. Kill him! Kill the umpire! Now it's coming on his hand, and it's likely they'll kill him. Had not Casey raised his hand, with a smile of Christian charity, great Casey's visage gone. He stilled the raising tumult, he bade the game go on. He signaled to the pitcher, and once more the ball is blue. But Casey still ignored it, and the umpire said, strike four! Third, the maddened thousand cried, and echo answered third. But a single look from Casey, and the audience was asked. They saw his face grow stern and cold. They saw his muscles strain. They know that Casey wouldn't let that ball go by again. The sneer is gone from Casey's lips. His teeth are clenched in head. He pounds his cold hail and twist back upon the threat. And now the pitcher holds the ball. And now he lets it go. And now the air is shattered by the force of Casey's blow.
With the turn of the 20th century and the spread of urban and industrial living, the structure, pacing and timing, and the material of American humor began to change comedians of this era. Often dependent on fast-paced joke delivery, slapstick, outrageous or lewd innuendo, and an ethnic persona always built around their based routines on popular stereotypes. During the stand-up eras of minstrel, vaudeville, and burlesque, jokes were generally considered to be in the public domain, and humorous material was widely shared, appropriated, and stolen. Industrialized American audiences sought entertainment as a way to escape and confront city living. These recordings were a precursor to the stand-up comedy routine. Thank you for listening. This has been Dead Wax 78. I'm Sean. Hope you liked the show. And you know what? I'll catch you on the flip side.